from the JAMA Network. This is the JAMA Pediatrics Editor Summary, a discussion of the most important articles published in the latest issue of JAMA Pediatrics. Here are your hosts, Frederick Rivara and Dimitri Christakis.
Hi, podcast listeners. This is Dimitri Christakis, Editor-in-Chief of JAMA Pediatrics. And with me, as always, is my friend, colleague, mentor, and sidekick, Dr. Fred Rivara, Editor-in-Chief of JAMA Network Open. We're here with two, I think, interesting and different papers from this month's JAMA Pediatrics. Fred, actually, it's good to have you here. We have, he won't say it, so I'll say it, one of the world's experts on traumatic brain injury to discuss a paper related to sport-related concussion.
Well, you know, the whole field of pediatric concussion is evolving. And for a long time, the feeling out there was that the best way to recover from a concussion was to really do nothing, to sort of sit in a dark room, what was called brain rest, cognitive rest, which I don't know what that means. I guess don't think.
Well, a lot of us do that all the time, actually.
No physical activity. And there have been some studies to show that that idea of no physical activity was probably a bad idea. And I think we've talked a little bit about this in a previous podcast, but, you know, we have patients who have more severe traumatic brain injury. We work hard to get them into physical rehab and inpatient rehab, and for that you have to do 3 hours of active therapy a day. So there's a little cognitive dissonance here of the idea with mild brain injury, you do nothing, and the kids with more severe brain injury, you do a lot. So things have changed. And this is a paper from John Letty, who's an investigator up in Buffalo. He's been really very active in his field. And he did a randomized controlled trial to look at whether a active physical activity intervention early on would be harmful in any way, but also, in fact, whether it would be helpful in terms of the resolution of symptoms. So this was a study of youth with concussions, and they were studied relatively soon after their concussions. And the idea was to give them an exercise regimen that would just be below the threshold at which they would get symptoms. So it's called the sub-threshold aerobic exercise program. And the way he determined this was he put these kids on a treadmill and had them exercise until they developed symptoms. He says, okay, so exercise at a point of 80% heart rate at that at which you develop symptoms. So kind of give them a benchmark.
Concussion symptoms.
Not dyspnea symptoms, yeah. But concussion symptoms. The most common symptoms that kids would get might be headache. So he had this regimen and sent these kids out to do that, and then they would check in weekly if they weren't better with their RA, come back to the lab, get reassessed, and have a new threshold done. And they're supposed to exercise at least 20 minutes a day or to the point at which they develop symptoms. And he followed these kids for about 4 weeks after entry into the program. And again, these were done pretty soon after the concussions. And what he found is that the kids who were in this sub-threshold exercise group did better in terms of their ability to recover than kids who were in the control intervention, which was a stretching program. Now, there was no really difference in the level of symptoms because they both decreased over time. But in terms of the kids that were back to normal, the kids in the sub-threshold exercise group got there quicker.
How much quicker, Fred? 4 days.
4 days.
That's a lot.
That's a lot. When you think about
that's four missed days of school.
Yeah.
Four.
I mean, the thing is that the intervention group, it was 13 days. The control group was 17 days till they recover. And we know that one of the things for adolescents who have a concussion, if they're not able to get to school, that increases stress. It increases anxiety. And that makes the symptoms
Never mind
worse.
Driving the parents nuts.
Right. Just like because of the snowstorms, you can't send your kid to school and it drives you crazy, which we had here in Seattle recently.
That's right. No popcorn.
Kids with concussion because they can't go fully back to school until they recover. So I think this is an important intervention. Now, it's important for our listeners to understand that doing physical activity is different than going back to play.
Good point.
And the important thing about going back to play is that going back to football or basketball or soccer, there's a risk that you could hit your head and get another concussion. We don't want to have kids even try to go back to play until they're really fully able to exercise and go back to school. And then after that, they can go through the return to play protocol. But there's two different things here. And I think what's important is that you can have kids exercise after a day or two of some rest after concussion and to gradually increase their time exercising until they really feel like they're back to normal.
And we should point out, as you did, this is a fast-moving field. And what that means, I think, for a lot of kids and, frankly, for a lot of providers is that you need to keep up because you're giving recommendations that are dated that have serious implications. My daughter had a – I speak from personal experience. My daughter had a concussion 6 months ago and, in fact, was prescribed fairly aggressive brain rest by both the trainer at school and her pediatrician. And in spite of my consultations with you, it was very challenging to get her to go against what everyone else was recommending.
Right. You know, and I think it's a really important point is that pediatricians do need to provide the appropriate care here, and what you learned in residency probably isn't true anymore.
Residency, even a year ago,
a year
or two years ago.
So, you know, this is a really fast-moving field. I was involved with a concussion report that was published, I think, back in 2013, now 6 years ago, and a lot of that stuff we said there is probably outdated. Because fortunately, there's been some good research that has gone on in the meanwhile, and this is a very good paper, I think, to demonstrate that.
So just for our listeners who are clinicians, it is now expert opinion based on a sound evidence base that this quote-unquote cognitive rest or brain rest is no longer recommended.
Right. And there was another randomized controlled trial published in that other pediatric journal a number of years ago.
The one with no name.
Done by a guy named Danny Thomas in Wisconsin. And he showed that kids that were put at rest compared to kids that were given some degree of activity soon after the concussion had better outcomes than the kids who were put at rest. So I think now we have two good randomized studies to show that you shouldn't have kids be put in a cocoon and be completely at rest. They should, you know, rest for a day or so. But if they're feeling willing to go back to school, let them go back to school. Let them walk around the block. Let them get on the exercise bike a little bit. Don't let them go back and play football, but get them active again.
Great. Okay, great. Okay, so the next study we have is called The Effect of a Breakfast in the Classroom Initiative on Obesity in Urban School-Aged Children, a Cluster Randomized Clinical Trial. So, Fred, what did your mother tell you about breakfast?
You always need to eat breakfast before going to school.
It's the most important meal of the day. My mother told me the same thing. I guess that's Greeks and Italians aligned.
Although what we probably ate was sugar-sweetened cereal.
That's true. The most important meal of the day botched. Anyway, so I think there's been a general consensus that breakfast is really important for school-age kids to eat, particularly low-income school-age children who might otherwise be undernourished. And yet, there's a paucity of data to suggest what the effects are. Now, traditional breakfast at school as a means of increasing low-income kids' ability to eat breakfast is offered in the cafeteria before school starts. And it's been shown that a lot of kids don't take advantage of it, primarily because it requires getting to school earlier than they otherwise would, which, you know, who the hell wants to do that at any age? And so there's been this movement now to provide breakfast in the classroom at the start of school rather than in the cafeteria before school. And it's unclear what the effects of that might be. In fact, it's believed that that would increase uptake for obvious reasons. But what would the effects of that be on overweight and obesity? And in fact, consistent with the mantra that breakfast is the most important meal of the day, not just for learning, but for obesity, some studies have found an association between eating breakfast and decreased weight, kind of the opposite of what you might think if you thought simply about the number of calories you take in.
Well, the idea, you know, about eating breakfast is that then you're not so hungry, I mean, for school kids, so you can then pay attention, but also that you then don't overeat at lunch.
Exactly. Anyway, these previous studies have been observational and have found that there were benefits. This group actually did a cluster randomized controlled trial to test whether or not there was a difference in obesity and overweight. And I should point out, as they did, that their hypothesis based on observational studies was that, in fact, providing breakfast in the classroom would increase the uptake of children eating breakfast at school, which would subsequently reduce the rates of obesity and overweight in low-income kids. So they did this study, a 2.5-year cluster randomized controlled study in 16 schools, 4th through 6th grade in Philadelphia. It was 1,362 students. And in the classroom intervention, it was not just breakfast in school, but they also added a nutritional educational program. In fact, in some ways, you might argue they were even worried about the fact that kids would eat extra breakfast if they made it more available. And they tried to couple it with what makes a healthy breakfast, what's healthy calorie intake. And it wasn't just in the classroom. They mailed newsletters to parents. It was a fairly moderate touch, let's say, nutritional intervention along with breakfast in school. And to cut to the punchline, what did they find? Well, the good news is that, I suppose the good news is that they didn't actually find any difference between the intervention and control schools and the combined incidence of overweight and obesity after 2.5 years. So overweight and obesity combined. But the incidence of obesity was higher in the intervention schools than the control schools after 2.5 years, with a prevalence of 28% versus 21% for an odds ratio of 1.46.
So no good deed goes unpunished.
So really finding the exact opposite of what they hypothesized would be true in a very rigorously done study, not the findings anyone would like to see, and kind of begs the question of, what do we do now? So, Fred, what do we do now?
Well, I think, you know, I was trying to read this paper and look at what exactly was the food that was offered. So they say it met USDA regulations, fruit, 100% fruit juice, which, you know, we don't really want to give to kids, milk and grains, and average 450 to 500 calories per meal. I guess that's really the question here of, is it food with a high glycemic index, which we know is more prone to obesity?
So they should be doing the ketogenic diet or the keto, the paleo diet. And
you know, was it sugar puffs or some other kind of, you know, cereal, Fruit Loops? What was it that these kids were offered?
Yeah.
I think there's food and there's food. And it may be that particularly in the schools, we know the schools don't have a particularly large food budget. And was it really high-quality food or just high-caloric density food?
It's a very good question, and I think, in fact, providing sort of higher protein content is more expensive to do than providing simply, as you said, grains, milk, and juice. I think that's one thing. And what's missing from this, and it was not their primary objective, which is look just at obesity, as you alluded to, is what's the trade-off? Were there actually benefits in terms of attendance?
Yeah, it would be nice to know whether these kids did better in school.
Maybe it's worth a couple of points at a population level. Yes.
Yeah, I mean, if they ended up performing better and getting better academic scores, then maybe it was worth it.
Yeah. It is interesting, and I really, as I said, I applaud the authors for doing it and being very clear about what their objectives were and sharing with us. It's not even, I would say, a negative study, right? We do publish well-done negative studies. This is actually one step further. It proves the opposite of what you, in fact,
hypothesis. It's a study that shows harm. And, you know, I think I want to applaud the authors for doing this because this is the kind of research that's important to do. And we can't keep on assuming that whatever we do for kids is good. Here's a good example to show that, you know, there might be some hidden harms.
Great. All right. Well, thank you all very much for spending a few minutes with us in your car or in your homes. And we will see you next month at our podcast. You can also see previous episodes at www.jamapediatrics.com. Thank you, Fred. We'll see you all next month.
Thank you.